Hey folks, Carolyn here to tell you just a little bit about the Games and Online Harassment Hotline. It's a free, text message-based, confidential emotional support hotline that was created specifically for the gaming community. So whether you're a player, a developer, a streamer, a competitor, any part of the gaming community, the hotline is here for you, ready to provide emotional support or help finding the referrals and resources that you may need. Visit gameshotline.org for more information.
This film, I loved every minute of it, but there was a certain little nugget of anxiety that I carried throughout, because we are so accustomed to seeing like trauma perpetrated against queer people on screen that I was just waiting for it.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by two women who were definitely just out at the movies until 3 a.m. Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And Ebony Adams.
The movie ran late.
I didn't know I was going to a Lord of the Rings movie marathon. I thought,
but when you accept a movie invitation from me, that's probably a safe bet.
Fair, yeah, yeah. Now, lesson learned.
And the Hobbit series, all in
no,
one.
Oh, good no, Lord. I would not include that. Come on, here.
Don't you know?
Let's
anything?
Not be ridiculous, Anita.
Too much. All right. Well, this week we're kicking off a month of episodes focusing on films by Black creators with a conversation about Dee Reese's 2011 directorial debut. Oh boy, Pariah. Stay tuned.
Now, in Anita's defense, she has been off for the past 2 weeks, so words like directorial, you know, you have to warm up the mouth muscles and everything.
That's
used
right.
To saying those 5-syllable words again. So, welcome.
Do you miss having a cast member who can't pronounce anything? Did you miss that?
Well, welcome back.
Yes, we did.
Anita.
We did, but welcome back. We missed you.
As longtime listeners know, in our scripts, Carolyn and Ebony literally write phonetically words that they know I'm going to mess up because I'm terrible.
People do that for other folks, Anita. Like, you are by no means the only person, you know, who needs like phonetic spellings for things.
I appreciate you making me feel better, even though I still find it very embarrassing.
Listen, you could have primed the old podcast pump before you jumped on, but we'll get there. By like the wrap up, we should be fine.
How are you two doing?
I'm tired as hell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You should take a break too. Huh.
Yeah, I should. You want to talk to everybody asking for things? Clear that?
Nope.
Yeah. Oh, good news. It looks like Team Liquid won their tournament. And so they chose the Games and Online Harassment Hotline, you know, as their charity to support. And we are just incredibly, incredibly grateful for that shout out and for the donation that's coming our way. They're helping us do incredible, incredible work. So
yeah,
thanks,
man,
y'all.
This happened. Well, so I was off for 2 weeks and like, I literally near the beginning, Ebony's like, hey, I got a thing. I was like, I don't care. Don't care. Not talking to anyone.
And then it turns out it was something she should have cared about. But, you know, I'm like the Henny Penny. You never know when what I'm telling you is an actual emergency.
It's true.
Is it Henny Penny that I'm thinking of? Boy, who cried a wolf? Whatever. Y'all, listen, the point is Anita knows when not to pay attention to my WhatsApp messages.
It's true. Anyways, but so I got back. And so Team Liquid is a League of Legends esports team, and they won the like pre-championship or their pre-season champions. I don't know how things work. And Riot is donating money to the nonprofit of the team's choice, and we were their choice, and that's super exciting. And what a lovely thing to come back to work learning.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, thanks y'all. I really appreciate it. It's going to the hotline specifically.
Yeah.
Just to be clear.
It is not going to me if you were worried.
I tried to arrange it.
I was like, listen, y'all, just, you know, write me the check. I'll make sure Anita gets it.
Well, I mean, it's not going to this stupid podcast. It's actually going to help
yeah,
people.
But maybe if someone gave us, you know, a bunch of money, the podcast wouldn't be so stupid anymore.
That's true. I mean,
like, fair. If someone wants to write us a giant check, I will definitely take time off from my full-time job
but
and
hey,
do a little more prep.
think about all of our patrons who donate to us enjoying our stupid, or well, I guess we shouldn't use that word, but enjoying what we do here at Feminist Frequency, mm-hmm. warts and all.
Yeah, it can't all be hate listens, right?
Yeah. Anyways, I'm very sad to have missed the episode about Promising Young Woman. And I don't actually know what you all said, but holy shit, I already talked Carolyn's ear off about it.
But we can talk about it in the bonus.
Yeah,
you know, maybe. We can have an extra long bonus.
Maybe. All right.
But yeah.
Well, let's get into this. With the release of her acclaimed film, Mudbound, in 2017, Dee Reese reached new levels of fame and also became the first Black woman ever to be nominated in the Best Adapted Screenplay category at the Academy Awards. But 6 years prior, in 2011, she'd released a low-budget independent film that had announced her as a major talent. That film was Pariah, the story of a young Black lesbian named Aliki living in Brooklyn and struggling to assert herself and live her truth, even as her parents make it painfully clear that they will not accept that their daughter is gay. Described by Reese as semi-autobiographical, the film vibrates with authenticity as it captures the anguish and the joy of Aliki's efforts to live an authentic life.
Like, I don't even know how to describe to somebody who hasn't seen this film what makes it feel so authentic, but you just, like, you just know watching this, or you just feel watching this film like you are getting just an honest window into mm-hmm. a world of experience that is true, like that is true and that is real, and it's so complex and multifaceted and human, and all the whole range of emotions are there. And I mean, you know, I have to give tremendous credit not only to Dee Reese but to Adepero Oduye, who plays Aliki, who is just phenomenal as the star of this film. You know, she has like one of those smiles that just like lights up a room and lights up the screen. And so she, like, you as a performer, just because of her presence, you are like let in to Alike's like emotional world, right? And like this film should have made her as an actor a star. Like, I'm like, mm-hmm. I watched this film and I'm like, why am I not seeing, you know, she's had other work. Like, she, you know, she does work as an actor, but I'm like, oh my God, like this, she should be, you know, like after this film, I'm like, oh my God, please like let her star in more things, 'cause she is so great. Yeah.
So good. Also, I mean, like, I'll get into, you know, actual like important non-superficial stuff, but Adepero Oduye was 33 when this movie came out, playing the 17-year-old Aliki. And I'm like, you could have told me she was 15.
Holy
and
shit,
I would have bought
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those examples of, like, I didn't find out she was that age until I looked her up on Wikipedia afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, she's like practically my age. Because, you know, like, yeah, like, you know, we make fun of, oh, 90210, you know, watching that mm-hmm. is because like all those actors were like 30 or whatever. But this, I totally bought it. Like, I totally bought her in that role.
Just phenomenal performances by everyone mm-hmm. in this. And I mean, as angry and as sad as Kim Wayans makes me in this movie as Alike's mother, still just such mm-hmm. a phenomenal performance mm-hmm. by her. And Pernell Walker as Laura. Gotta give a shout out to my man, Rob Morgan. I always love seeing that dude, even when he's absolutely fucking horrible, you know, or playing an absolutely horrible character on screen. But this film, I'm so glad that we're starting our, you know, spotlight on Black filmmakers this month with this film. Because for one thing, one of the like constant criticisms of, you know, queer media that comes out is how much of it is just overwhelmingly white, you know, and is, you know, given to us through a white lens. And so, like, we need to be, you know, supporting and showcasing more work like this about Black queers. But also, this film, it's so large, and yet it's so small at the same time. You know, it is so particular. Kara, when you talked about how, like, there's this real, like, tangible feeling to it that utterly convinces you of its authenticity, you know, it is so specific, and yet it manages to convey, you know, this larger notion of like how, you know, like young gay kids often like come to learn about themselves and how they can navigate in in a world that ask them to minimize themselves or change themselves. Like it's just an incredible achievement in the way that like her story is so particular. And yet I don't want to use the term universal,
right.
But you know, it really, you know, it's such a real feeling movie.
I mean, I do not in any way want to diminish like the specificity and the blackness, like the quintessential blackness of this film, because it absolutely has that. But at the same time, like there were, of course, ways, and I think this is perfectly legitimate and understandable and valid, that I, as a trans person who, when I was younger, knew that my parents would never accept that I was trans and could feel that, just that thrumming pressure in the family, in the dynamics of the family in which I was growing up. Like the family dynamics in this film, like they're so complex, they are so specific, and yet they are so like, I mean, I think there is something about them that echoes across, you know, so many people's experiences of what it is to be other, right? To be not what, to not fit into the mold that your parents and society, you know, expects you or pressures you or demands really that you fit into.
I love how you started talking about this, Carolyn, the honesty of the film, like that that's so important to what this movie is. And like you were saying too, all of the filmmaking elements contribute to it. But at the end of the day, like this film, it feels, it's hard to watch, right? Because it feels so true and it feels so sincere. And the conversations, the ways that people talk about Alike, or Lee, actually, as she wants to be called.
Sure, yes.
About her and to her was just so real. And like you know, there was, even though it's surrounding the story, the depth of like her mother, and you're just like, gosh. Oh, you know her mother, like my mom's nothing like her, but like, you know her mother right away. You know, she's controlling. She wants her daughter to be very, stereotypically feminine, and like it slowly reveals that she is, you know, she's trying to control her daughter because she can't control her own life.
Yeah,
right.
I love how like Lee, Lee, like not like the parents would be approving or accepting of Lee regardless, but there is a way in which Lee becomes a kind of focal point because of all the other surrounding problems in the marriage, in the relationship between her parents that they cannot confront or resolve directly. And I mean, this is like an 86 minute film, right? This film comes in at like under 90 minutes, and yet it charts such, you know, in that time, it economically and precisely charts like such complex but easily understandable, you know, emotional and psychological territory, which is remarkable.
Yeah. I do also want to talk about the visuals of this film is also, I think, part of what sets it apart, right? Like it's, I don't mean to say part twice, but you know, it's an independent, small budget, you know, whatever, but it's so beautiful, and the creative choices of the visual choices, the editing choices that are made is what also lends itself to the ability to make something that is pretty short in, you know, movies nowadays, but with such depth, right? Like it doesn't even feel like it's missing anything. It just feels like it contained so much. And there's these moments where, like, you know, near the end when she realizes that, I guess we do spoilers, but she's very, very upset because she feels a little like lied to and taken advantage of. And, you know, while the camera is very smooth through the rest of the film, like this one moment, you know, it's handheld. She's walking down the street. She's angry. She's kicking trash cans. And the camera is just shaking the whole time. And it's like, you feel it in your soul, you know, like you feel it right there of how angry and upset she is. And I think that they do such a beautiful job of, like, you know, the tones and the colors and the framing to just show how like trapped she feels, right? In the, like, the darkness of the club, the, like, the angles in which they're shooting her in, you know, the scenes where, you know, she's on the bus and she's changing and like, she takes off, like, you know, all of the stuff around clothing in it, I think it did so, so much to tell this story, because like she's trying on different things throughout the whole movie, right? Like she's not her friend Laura, even though her friend Laura keeps trying to put her in a particular style of like butch lesbian, right? Like there's a particular aesthetic that she's going for that you can tell Lee doesn't really feel like is her necessarily, but she keeps just trying on different things. And then you get to the dildo scene and you're just like, oh God, you poor thing.
I don't think it's so much that the butch aesthetic is not for her, is that she doesn't quite know what version of it is hers. And she I love that scene that you referenced, you know, where at the beginning of the film where she's coming back from the club night and she makes sure that Laura gets off the bus before her so that she can complete her transformation. And it is so magnificently done. And it highlights so much about how gender presentation is dependent upon these seemingly small things to entirely determine how someone is received in the world, right? So it's not as if she like puts on a full face of makeup, puts on a dress, you know, and gets like ball gown kitted out. She simply puts on some small earrings, takes off her, you know, her fitted and her do-rag, changes her shirt, and then the transformation, you know, back into like a safe gender presentation, as far as her mother is concerned, is complete, you know? And then, you know, yeah, so there's...
It is also kind of shocking to see. Like, she really does look so different, right? Yeah. Like, it just visually was such an incredible... I mean, it's not a storytelling technique. It's a part of the story itself, but, like, it held so much weight.
Yeah, and just, like, you know, the way that she is in, you know, fairly muted or dark colors throughout much of the film. And then as more lightness suffuses her decision not to run away, but to choose, you know, we see Lee in, you know, brighter, you know, like more jewel tones at the end of the film. And then there's that great mirroring done. So we see Lee on the bus at the beginning, coming back from that club night, you know, with that very melancholy, you know, and blues and greens, you know, at night on the bus, and then at the end, leaving on the bus, head again against the window of the bus, but wearing like this bright yellow.
Oh, totally. Which also, I was like, she ain't taking a bus from fucking New York to Berkeley. Are you kidding me?
But it's like to the airport. Done it. I think it's probably.
I've done it.
Yeah.
I took that 3-day trip and it was not fun. Mm-hmm. That's how it is.
Yeah. So I thought like a lot of her efforts at changing her clothing and the secrecy of it is both her being like not feeling like she has and does not have the space to explore, like, you know, her quote unquote true self, right? Like, you know, in high school, a lot of us, you know, tried on all kinds of different like attitudes and music and clothing, and like it's kind of a time traditionally, I guess, when you try to figure out like what your interests are and you go all over the place, right? But she has to do it in secret. So she's constantly like getting to school and changing her clothes at school and then having to change them again to go back home, which I've done, not for this reason, but I definitely had to like hide some of the shit I was wearing because it was definitely not acceptable in my home. But like, you know, when the strap on, I think, was a really important moment, and it's funny, but also like, but it's not like it's very serious that like this is she's being told that she needs to like be tougher. Right. I think that the language in the film was like, yeah, you know, she might be cute, but, you know, she needs to be a little bit harder.
Yeah.
And so being harder means that she needs to like, you know, look a certain way and feel a certain way. And so she's like, OK, I'm going to like wear a strap. And she does, and she fucking hates it, right? And she, like, she feels constricted by it. And, you know, it's just another example of her being stuck in, like, her trying on different things and nothing feeling right.
But I think, crucially, part of what makes her uncomfortable about this strap is that it's white.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's not just that, like, it's the wrong size. Like, oh my gosh, can we talk in the bonus about getting properly fitted for shit, you know, and like not just having your friend go off and buy these things for you, unless that's literally the only way that you can get them. But again, you know, like this is something that she's been thinking of before, because when she and Laura have that conversation, she's like, hey, I need you to get something for me. And there's that funny, you know, conversation where Laura's like, what? And then, you know, figures out what she's asking for. Clearly, this is a conversation that that they've had before. But the impetus, you know, the rush to do it is based upon, you know, Mika, played by Afton Williamson, you know, saying like, oh, yeah, you know, she'd be cute if she was a little bit harder. You know what I found so interesting in that scene, those girls in the high school, is how much just in that brief scene you see the way that like traditional gender presentation or like, you know, popularity or pretty status. I don't want to necessarily say privilege, but status, you know, gives you freedom to say and do certain things, because it then, you know, prepares us for what happens with Bina, right? Because Bina can then, you know, initiate intimacy with Lee and then be like, I'm not gay.
Yeah.
I'm just playing around, right? And, yeah. And this is something that's fairly safe for her to do as someone who identifies as not gay, as someone who's very pretty, you know, someone who's got the love and acceptance of her parents in a way that Lee doesn't have access to. If Lee were to behave in the exact same ways, she would not be as accepted for saying it. And she knows that.
And God, like, this film really makes you feel Lee's anguish in the wake of that morning and that you know, encounter with Bina, that realization that what had happened the night before meant one thing to her and something completely different to Bina. And I think it's just like that feeling Lee has, because, you know, she's not getting love or validation at home from her parents. She's not, you know, able to find like love and validation in any, you know, romantically in the world. Like just that, you know, she goes home and she's just like curls up on the floor and she's just sobbing. And you just feel that anguish of like wondering, like, when will I ever be seen and loved for like who I am? And I mean, I do like that this film, we do see a larger community, like through, mm-hmm. I think, largely through like Laura and, you know, through the club and all of that, which, you know, is great. I also love the way that through Laura, we, you know, the film touches on things like the economic marginalization and risk that a person, you know, takes by being, you know, by living authentically as a queer person or sometimes does. I mean, so Laura's living like with her sister, and because her mom has kicked her out, and there's bills piling up, and there's so many bills to which they just say, let it ride, like they, because they cannot pay the bills. And so, like, I mean, I just really appreciated that this film, you know, it's trying to touch on all of like the socioeconomic realities, the social ostracism and, you know, being marginalized or just ostracized. Like all of these things are present in the film.
Oh, like Laura, the way that she exists at the intersection of multiple marginalizations. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's that scene, you know, with her and her sister deciding like, we can pay half on this. Right. We can pay 2/3 on that. Like, whoa, that's a conversation that like, that's real, you know?
Yeah, sure is.
But then the one that really hit me was how after her night out hanging with her friends, she has someone back to the apartment. She's like, okay, my sister gets back at 6. So you got to be out of here by then. Woman, you know, crashes out on the couch behind her, and then Laura opens up her books to start studying, you know, for the GED. And I was like, this is so real. The work that it takes some people just to survive, just to get by, to get a little bit of something is inconceivable to people who don't have to, you know, like navigate a tough world in that way. To, you know, be thinking like, okay, I'm 17, 18, whatever years old, you know, I'm trying to figure out how I can, you know, go to school or get my GED, but I'm also working as much as I can to put food on the table, to keep the lights on at the same time that I'm trying to like, just live, you know, as a young person and embrace life. It was just like, that hit me so much. The way she just like, she's shrouded in darkness. There's just that one spotlight on the book and she simply gets down to work. Woo.
Yeah. I want to talk briefly about the harassment scene in the liquor store. Because this is where we get more notified or like understand more about the father ignoring or like refusing to accept that his little girl that he loves and has a really lovely relationship with sort of is queer. And, mm-hmm. you know, his friends being homophobic reinforces to him, like, it can't be this way. Like, this cannot happen around me. And, you know, the scene involves a visibly queer, whatever that fucking means, woman coming into the store. And one of the dudes is like, yo, you go by sir or miss, sir or miss. And like, you know, he calls her a he, she dyke, and just all of this like really offensive stuff. And it was so, I don't know. It just reminded me a lot of like what, so my first partner in high school was pretty butch, and we like, she constantly got called sir or was like yelled at when she would go into the women's restrooms. And, you know, it was just like just because of the way she dressed and had short hair, you know, and like, it's such a part of your life that you have to deal with. And I feel like we understand this conversation a little bit more, especially with like, the popularity of trans stories coming forward around these issues. But like, that everywhere you go, you're constantly like, I think this was important not only for the father, but also as like storytelling of like existing in the world, looking differently than society has deemed you to look. Like, it means you're constantly under everyone's scrutiny, and there's always the risk of violence. There's always the chance of judgment and harm. And I think that this scene did a lot to show, you know, not just the day-to-day of dealing with your family, but like that the day-to-day of dealing with the world.
And
it was so, this film, I loved every minute of it, but there was a certain little nugget of anxiety that I carried throughout, because we are so accustomed to seeing like trauma perpetrated against queer people on screen, that I was just waiting for it. And when we do have like lashing out of violence, it's, you know, I think crucially like within the home that it occurs. It's not out on the street. But after that scene with, again, Rob Morgan, who I love, playing Socks, the asshole, in the liquor store, I was so afraid, you know, like, okay, Lee is going to get clocked going in or out of that club, and something horrible is going to happen. And just the way that like that danger and that threat exists for everyone in that world, you know, that you never know who's going to see you. And so earlier when Lee is introduced to Bina and her mother outside church, and Bina's like, oh yeah, you know, like I've seen you at school, and I was like, oh shit, what is she gonna reveal?
I was so freaked
just
out
like,
by
exactly,
that.
Just the fear, the constant fear that you have to walk through the world carrying. And so that's why those scenes of like Laura with her friends were so comforting, because just the presence of those other people around to witness and protect and surround each other, you know, offers maybe an illusion, but certainly a sense of protection from the dangers of the world. But yeah, I mean, I felt like I was walking a tightrope. I never knew when there was going to be just like, you know, an eruption of like hardcore homophobic violence in this. It, just like people walk through the world never knowing when they're going to be targets.
But that is all true. But I love how this film knows the more subtle pain of the subtle kind of erasure or dismissal or evasion. And so, you know, the father who we see in that liquor store scene, you know, with his friends, you know, then at home, right? Like, there's a scene where Lee, you know, I mean, because yeah, Lee loves her dad, and they, you know, they do, like, under certain conditions, they have what could be called a good relationship. So Lee, like, you know, tries to like open up a bit to her dad and starts talking about like, what if this person likes you, and, you know, this and that and that, you know, and the dad just has to go, and he knows exactly, on some level, consciously or not, he knows exactly mm-hmm. what he's doing when he when he kind of cuts Lee off, he's like, hey, what's his name? You know, I'm going to like look him up in the system, or because he's a cop, you know, or whatever. And then from there goes on to sort of like this kind of acknowledgement almost that Lee is gay, but that we're not going to talk about it by saying, oh, so there's this gay club, this gay women's club or whatever. You don't know anything about that, do you? And like the, with the undertones being very clear, like, you know, it's this feeling, and you get it in both parents in this film, that they cannot accept the idea of their daughter being gay, because somehow that would be like some kind of shameful reflection on them or something, like something that they just can't face. Obviously, Audrey's, the mother's, refusal to acknowledge Lee's sexuality and Lee's identity is tied up in her faith, like in her religion. And so she, at one point, like, she deploys the phrase, early in the film, she deploys the phrase, like, God doesn't make mistakes. Which, like, and it's like, as soon as she said that, I made a little note, because I immediately was thinking about how, well, that phrase can be deployed to mean two completely oppositional right. things, right? Like, Audrey is saying, like, all, like, Audrey basically means by that, like, all men are, you know, all people assigned male at birth are cisgender straight men. All people assigned female at birth are cisgender straight women. You know, maybe they don't really know it, but that's like what they are. And if they think otherwise, they're confused, because God doesn't make mistakes. And right. so I was so glad when Lee turned that phrase around later in the film and said, tell mom she's right. God doesn't make mistakes. Meaning, like, you know, I am who I am intrinsically. Like, God, if God made me, then God made me who I am. But oh my God, like, the pain in that final, the last thing Audrey says to her is, I'll be praying for you. And she does it in that way, that kind of like sanctimonious, smiling, kind of emotionally detached way that
she couldn't even tell her daughter she loved her. Like, fuck off.
I mean,
which is, but it's sadly like a reality.
Right. Exactly. Like, it is so true. Like, the way that parents, that some parents, particularly, you know, if they like can just kind of like disconnect and like look down on their own children from this place of, you know, yeah, this like sanctimonious place. It's so painful, and it's so hurtful, and this film just nails it with that final scene.
Yeah. I wanted to point out that this film came out in 2011. Mm-hmm. That, like, I think that that's important, because it's not like we are drowning in you know, Black queer films and stories by any means, but we have seen the media landscape change. And I just kept thinking about how, like, this film came out in 2011, and how, like, profound that is in that moment when we didn't really have, you know, there were very few, like, stories like this that are getting through, that are getting funded, that are getting made, and how remarkable it is that this did.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, Anita. So at the time that we're recording this, the Sundance Film Festival is still going on. It's happening virtually this year, 2021. One of the panels that I checked out was called Barbed Wire Kisses Redux. And it was the 30th anniversary of a panel done in 1992 called Barbed Wire Kisses. And it was all about new queer cinema. And it was absolutely fascinating. And if you have the chance to check out the recording, I suspect it will be made available, even if you didn't get a Sundance pass. But you have a chance, because it's done in two parts. And so the moderator had several people who were on that original panel, like Isaac Julian, or I think Greg Araki was on the first panel. Lisa Chulodenko, you know, Rose Troche, whatever. And then the second part is a lot of newer filmmakers. Cheryl Dunye took part.
Oh, nice.
And what's really interesting about it is the way that they talk about how, you know, this label, New Queer Cinema, arose in the early 90s, and how, like, that the type of independent film that was being made, not necessarily only, you know, in New York or in major urban centers, but a lot of it concentrated there in these artistic communities. It it wasn't that they were meant to be consumed by small audiences, but there simply were not the distribution networks available. And so I wonder if this film had been made in, you know, 1994, it might have been something that, like, I heard about in a college class, but never had the opportunity to see because there was no Netflix, there was no Amazon Prime. You know, fuck Jeff Bezos. But, you know, I didn't live in a town where there were, that showed, you know, independent films or whatever. So much of what we can embrace now in, you know, queer media is available to, it simply was not available back then. And so, yeah, like, I am so excited that we're seeing more of these stories, but that's one of the reasons why I'm glad that we're doing this salute to Black filmmakers throughout this month, because I think there's a lot of stuff out there that maybe people have heard of, but never got to see when it came out. And it's like, if the opportunity presents itself, there are these wide, vast rivers of amazing work that you could be checking out, blowing your mind with.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, check out that panel if you can. It's called Barbed Wire Kisses Redux. And it happened at Sundance a few days ago. And like I said, I suspect they'll put the recording up so that the general public can check it out.
Nice. I was also thinking about how we have gotten more queer films and representations in the media. And that I think there is a sense for those of us who are older, like, and went through this stuff. And like today, our friends and us are having children and like raising those children to, you know, if they're queer or trans or whatever, they could be whoever they want to be and that they'll be loved and accepted by their families. Right. And I'm watching this happen with my friends and their children. And so I think it's easy, a little bit easy, I guess. I don't know. This might be, privilege talking, but that to forget how like this story is still real and still happens for a lot of people, right? That it's not.
Oh yeah.
Well, there is, I don't want to erase the fact that there is a bigger acceptance of queer folks than there was before. Right. Like
right.
On a wider scale, yeah. But that for sure. And like, that's great and important, but also there are still people who are hiding the way they dress and who are afraid to talk to their parents.
And, I mean, there's,
And that we even, coming out is even a thing that has to happen,
like,
right? That,
yeah.
Like, the default is still very much cis and heterosexual. And so, you know, this film was beautiful and amazing and incredible and hard and really still relevant, you know?
Absolutely. Like, there's such a danger in looking at, like, the improved, say, media landscape and thinking, okay, well, those issues are in the past. Like, I mean, like, of course, as a trans person, I know that there are, you know, trans young people growing up in, you know, all over this country in families where they know they have to live in secrecy, that they can't speak their truth because they would never be accepted or embraced. And I mean, right now, like, legislation, you know, in multiple states there's an increased push lately in anti-trans legislation. So like to think that obviously like in Pride is not about a trans person, but the issue of like not adhering to gender conformity is very, very much a part of this film. And you know, yeah. I mean, so yeah, like. These battles are hardly, in the past. Like they are very much alive today.
Yeah. I you know, obviously, I feel very strongly that the media is an important force for progress, right? And that representations in the media, if they hold certain values, can help us be better people to each other, right? Mm-hmm. But this conversation is making me think about a part of Susan J. Douglas's book, Enlightened Sexism, which came out many, many years ago. I think I read it in college, where she talks about how there has been an increase at the time and now even there's an increase in like the media representation of female judges and female lawyers and doctors and like all of these women in positions of power. and how like that's not necessarily actually reflected in our society. And so like, does it make like it kind of makes us think that women hold more power than they actually do because of the over representation of those roles in media. And I remember like, even as I'm saying this now, like I remember reading that and being like, but okay. Like I always felt a little uncomfortable about that analysis and I couldn't quite nail it, but because like it's in conflict with the, like, if you see it, you can be it kind of mentality. Right. Which I've also never really liked very much. So I think that when we talk about like the media impact and media influence on us, you know, stories like Pariah, like this isn't a story about like you can dream it, you can be it kind of thing. This is a reality of a life, and like that I'm sure a lot of people can see a reflection of themselves in to some degree and their experiences in. But also I bring this up because we are talking about how like, but there are so many more stories now about like happy queer folks, and like that's fucking great. You know, mm-hmm. like that's wonderful that we have that, but we can't forget that like it's not, we're still living in a really terrible state for a lot of people, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I think like the issue of representation, like aspirational representation, is definitely something that needs to be unpacked. But, you know, before we wrap up, I do want to talk about, again, the importance of why we're doing this spotlight on Black creatives during this month. Not that we're going to confine, you know, our analysis of these kinds of films to the short month of February, but that there is a benefit to reminding people to widen their media consumption libraries. But like I said, before we wrap up, I do want to talk about one of the things that is so fantastic about this movie, again, is how specific it is. It's set in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and it is so vitally, inherently Black in all of its cultural references and its touchstones. So everything from, you know, Lee being told to wrap up her hair at night, removing her shoes when she comes in the house, the language, but also the way in which Black women are presented as, you know, objects of desire for other Black women. There is something so utterly convincing about the gaze in this film being assumed to be a Black gaze that will understand the language that is being employed, the card game that's being played, the fashion choices that are being made, the music choices that are being made, the kinds of relationships and dynamics between people, you know, the fact that, you know, like that scene in the liquor store with Lee's father, the liquor store owner, dumbass socks, you know, like these kinds of conversations, it's not that they don't happen in other cultures, but just the particular flavor of it, you know? As with the rest of the movie, is so quintessentially of this time, space, and people. And so, yeah, just shout out to Dee Reese. Phenomenal work.
Yeah. Thank you so much for bringing that up. I think that's such an important part of, yes. There was something in this movie that I kept being like, what does that mean? And I can't remember what it is now.
You were like, can I ask Ebony or can I not ask Ebony? What is worse?
I mean, that did pass through my head, but I think it was a queer reference that I didn't understand.
Was it AG? They used the term AG a couple of times.
Yeah.
In this film.
Oh, yeah. It just means like, you know, a butch girl. Like, it stands for like aggressive girl.
Oh, I never heard like that butch before. I'm surprised I've never heard that before. Anyways. Yeah, that was it. That was the one I didn't.
There you go.
And I didn't text you, Ebony, to be like, hey, Black friends.
Good, because I would have screenshot it and then been like, Courtney, can you please post this in the show notes?
Let's be honest. I have definitely done that to you before, but I
know that's what I'm saying, you know, like, and I saved those. I've saved those for your trial.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, buddy. All right, y'all. Please watch this movie. It's just remarkable in so many ways. And we'll be right back.
Hey, friends. Thanks for listening to FFR. If you enjoy our weekly conversations about the intersection of feminism and pop culture, consider hopping over to patreon.com/femfreak and joining our podcast community. You can get access to exclusive bonus episodes, join our friendly Discord server, participate in polls to help decide topics for future episodes, and more. Plus, you'll be helping us keep bringing FFR to the virtual podcast airwaves. Visit patreon.com/femfreak today.
Now it's time to talk about what's been thrilling us, moving us, upsetting us, or infuriating us this past week. Who's got a freak out? Carolyn, I think you have one.
Yeah, right? I do. I feel like I haven't talked about a game in a while. So, you know, and I've been in a bit of a rut, actually, when it comes to games, because, I don't know, it's just hard. Like, I'm in one of those windows, or I have been in one of those windows where, like, nothing I play feels particularly exciting or new or fresh. And I was looking for something that would just kind of invigorate me a little bit when it comes to games, like remind me that, oh, yeah, games can feel like fresh and original, and, you know, which is, you know, it's rare to come across such a game. So I played recently a game that actually came out in the later part of last year, but I only played it at the start of this year. And the game is called Paradise Killer. And this is such, in my mind, such an original, such a breath of fresh air on like multiple levels. And it's difficult to summarize what makes it that way. But when I say that, I'm talking aesthetically, like in terms of how the game looks and sounds, and in terms of the world that it offers you. So, in short, it's a kind of whodunit investigative game where there's been a murder and you have to investigate the murder and, you know, figure out who the guilty party or parties are, and then kind of convict them at this trial, which is not anything particularly like new for a game to do. But the world in which this game takes place is so refreshing, because it's definitely like a sci-fi fantasy game, but it's not a sci-fi or fantasy that borrows from the same kinds of influences that so many other games and other media borrow from. It's not fantasy in the sense of like Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, right? It's not sci-fi in the sense of like Star Wars, you know, or Star Trek or anything like that. It's really very original. It's a world, it takes place in a world where this group of people that's like trying to resurrect gods. And anyway, as you play the game, you learn all about the power dynamics and the personalities of the individuals on this council, and they're fantastic characters, which really helps make the game come alive too. They have names like Crimson Acid and Dr. Doom Jazz, and they're just these like larger these like larger than life characters that are, you know, again, are not like the characters that that you usually encounter in a game. And so, like, at first this game was kind of dizzying to me in the sense of like, or disorienting, because I'm like, I do not understand the logical underpinnings of this world. This is not like any world that a game has ever thrust me into before. I do not understand what the fuck is going on. But like, as you play it, you kind of come to understand it better and better. And it's like, you don't have to understand it completely. Like, it's okay to kind of just let this experience kind of wash over you and to just be in its world. But it really cultivates a feeling. You know, the feeling, I would say, is, you know, to me, it has sort of the pleasant feeling of like being in an empty shopping mall, or like there's a pleasant like isolation to its world. Its world is of just tremendous material excess, and, you know, it's very ostentatious, and it feels very like ideologically empty. And there's definitely political critique embedded in it of like fucked up power dynamics, and, you know, the masses being exploited by these privileged few to maintain their very comfortable lifestyle. So just a really interesting breath of fresh air that also works as a pretty interesting mystery that is fun to kind of put together the pieces of as you progress through the game. So I was really pleased to play such an original game to kind of kick off my 2021, and and I hope to find similarly original, invigorating games to play as the year continues.
Carol, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
A potentially pathetic question. Is it this sort of game that I could play.
Yeah. Yes.
You know what I mean by that?
Okay. It is. I would say, like, and here's the thing, though. Even I, the quintessential gamer, like, there were a few points where I looked up, you know, like, what am I supposed to do next, you know, online? Because I, you know, I knew I wanted to kind of see the whole story play out, and I wasn't really sure, you know, I knew that I was, like, missing something. So if you're willing, you know, if you're willing to consult a guide or look things up online occasionally, then I would say yes, absolutely. Like, there's no action challenges in the game. There's no way to, like, lose or die or fail.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's purely mostly about just running, you know, running around an island, talking to characters, and you have this, like, computer that kind of collates all the evidence for you and kind of nudges you in the right direction. So yeah, it's purely investigation and exploration.
Okay, this seems like something I can play, and it sounds very interesting. Yeah, I always worry because people describe stuff and it sounds awesome, and then I, you know, look it up and I'm like, it will take too much learning for me to, you know, figure out how to even maneuver a spot in this game. So
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I, as Ebony mentioned, the Sundance Film Festival is currently happening at the time of this recording. Actually, it's going to be happening when this comes out. Anyways, I watched a film at Sundance that premiered called The Pink Cloud. And, oh boy, it is a lot. It is a lot. I highly recommend it. I can't imagine it won't get picked up quickly for distribution. It's a Portuguese film by director Luli Gerbais. And it, so I'm avoiding, like, saying what it is. It is about a pandemic. Mm. It's about a pandemic. And it is so eerie because she wrote it in 2017 and filmed it in 2019. And as they were editing it during 2020, they were like, this is too real. Like, we are literally editing scenes that we are living at this moment. So in the film, instead of it being like a contagion that is passed, or a virus that is passed between people, these pink clouds appear over the entire world. And if you step into them, or if you go outside at all, you will die in 10 seconds. Huh. And so you literally cannot leave the building in which you are in. So if you are buying groceries, you are stuck at the grocery store with everyone else that's at the grocery store.
Oh, my God.
And so you're stuck in the house with whoever is with you or not with you. And like, I kind of don't want to give away too much. So I'm going to maybe not talk too much about it because I really want folks to have the opportunity to, like, watch it unfold as I did. I will say, though, because of that conceit, as soon as it was over, like, I stepped outside. Like, I was like, thank God you can go outside. Like, I went and bought groceries and, like, you know, the person at the butcher shop was like, you know, how's your day? I was like, I just watched this fucking movie.
they were like, okay, lady.
I was like, I'm really thankful that I can be in this grocery store right now. It is so odd how much it captures of our, like, experience today, you know, with its own conceits. But, like, the difference between being stuck in a house with someone versus being alone, you know, there's a lot to it. And it's, I think it was really, really well done. And it's a little hard to watch, to be honest, even though I think it's a pretty remarkable film. So I hope it gets picked up for distribution soon. Mm-hmm. So folks can check it out because it's very timely, even though I'm sure it wasn't intended to be.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Hey, you might have a freak out. And if you do, you can submit it at feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for listening to Feminist Frequency Radio. Join us next week as we talk about Julie Dash's landmark film, Daughters of the Dust. If you are a Patreon supporter, you can listen to our bonus episode that is exclusively for you. And yeah, that's it. Our show is engineered by Rob Pera. Carrie Stimson provides technical support, artwork by Jamie Varon, and our intro music is by Phil Circus. Thanks so much for listening.
Bye,
y'all. Thanks, everybody.